Thank you for the kind introduction. So it's a great pleasure to give the seminar here. And I really like giving these seminars at Perimeter. So even as a speaker, I've never worked out of a seminar there without learning something. So I'm really looking forward to this. So what I'm going to talk about today is quantum gravity on foliated spacetimes. So essentially, this is work that has been done with one of my PhD students, Jian Wang, and a master's student, Chris Korver. So let me see. Yes, I can move the slides. So the outline of the talk is as follows. So I will start with an introduction and motivation, essentially describing the objects that we want to compute. In the second part, there will be an interlude. There will be an introduction to asymptotic safety. So essentially, I will introduce the framework and the tools that I will use to do the computation. And then part three will be the results that we have found. And I will close with a summary and outlook. Then what I find important, even if the seminar is on Zoom, so please feel free to interrupt and ask questions. So this is highly welcome to make the seminar a lively experience for everybody. So let me start with a general motivation. So what we had in mind is we wanted to do a quantum the computation of phenomenological observables from first principles. And first principles in this case will be a theory of quantum gravity. Then we were thinking about what could be useful targets. And we were thinking about graviton fluctuations. So what we know very well from the classical theory is how gravitons propagate in a flat background. So this is symbolized here. And potentially, we will also be able to detect tensor fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background in the future. So the basic question that is around, can we use these observations to constrain quantum gravity? Now, before getting into the realm of the quantum theory, let's remind ourselves about gravitons and the fluctuations here, how we observe them in general relativity. So essentially, this serves as a motivation of the objects that we actually want to compute later on. Now, if we start from classical general relativity, we can look at Einstein's equations in vacuum. So R mu nu is the Ricci tensor, it's set to zero. And then we can consider a small perturbation around flat space. So G mu nu is my space-time metric, eta mu nu is my flat space metric, and tensor H mu nu here, this is the fluctuations that I want to consider. In the simplest case, I can adopt harmonic gauge. And what I get out of this exercise then is a massless wave equation for the metric perturbations that are sitting here. In addition to this wave equation, I also get additional constraints. Essentially, they are saying that the H mu nu here should be transverse and traceless. Now I can solve these equations in one particular example. So let's look at the plane wave propagating in the TZ plane. And then the solution will probably look like this. So the important properties that we need to take away here is that there are 2 degrees of freedom. So there's the phi plus and the phi cross polarization. The guy moves with the speed of light. And the degrees of freedom that we have here are in the spatial part. So all the time components of my fluctuations are set to zero. Now, let's take this as a takeaway message and see how we could embed this in a quantum gravity theory. So the first step, what we did is we took our spacetime M and we equipped it with a foliation structure. So that already appeared in the title. So we build out our M of out of stacks of spatial slices, which are then welded together. And in this way, the metric degrees of freedom are moved into a lattice function N. The metric measuring distances on spatial slices, so that's the sigma ij, and a shift vector ni. So at this point, this is a rewriting of the covariant metric. However, it comes with several benefits. So when we have this foliation structure, we also introduce the preferred direction. And if we have this structure around, this gives us the possibility of transiting between a Lorentzian and a Euclidean signature theory. So essentially, this is the extra structure that we need to go from a purely Euclidean spacetime to a Lorentzian spacetime just by having a preferred direction around, which could serve as time at a later stage. Also, the ADM variables are closely related to Badin variables. So this is useful if you want to formulate observables in your theory. Now, this is the setup for the foliation. Now, how do we match this with propagation in flat space? So we started with our ADM decomposition. We took the space-time metric. We decomposed it in labs, shift, and metric on spatial slices. And then we would like to introduce fluctuations around the flat background. So all the quantities that come here with a bar are background quantities, and the quantities that are with a hat are fluctuations around this background. If I specified my background to be flat, then the sigma bar will be just the Euclidean metric, the n bar will be equal to 1, and the background shift vector will be 0. So this is the flat space. And then I can further decompose my spatial metric using the transverse traceless decomposition. So this is depicted here. So there's a transverse traceless part, there is a transverse vector and two scalars coming up. The important part will be here, the transverse traceless part. So this guy carries 2 degrees of freedom. And if I do a diffeomorphism of my space-time coordinates, then this I will be invariant. So it's a gauge invariant quantity in this sense.
Frank?
Yes?
I have a question. When you set up the fluctuation around the flat background, sigma hat, ni hat, and hat fields, are those just the first order of an infinite expansion, or are you thinking of those as just the full expanded, non-expanded guy? I don't know if it's clear, the question.
The question is very clear. So we have been thinking about this. In our computation, they are the full guys. However, this might be not the best way to set up the computation. So in principle, I think one can gain a lot of structure by including higher orders of the fluctuations as well. We just have not done so.
Okay, thank you.
Good. We want to look at the Hij, and specifically the object that we want to look at is the two-point correlation function of this field. So in principle, this has the following structure that we want to consider. There is a prefactor which involves Newton's constant in the quantum theory that will act as a wave function randomization. And then there is essentially 2 powers of the H field and a free field propagator, and we allowed to have a mass term in between. So if I take the variation of this quantity with respect to H, then I will get a massive wave equation for this field. And if we want to relate this to phenomenology, then we have a prediction what this mass parameter, the mu squared that appears here, actually is. So we know that the gravitons are massless. So in the end, what we should get out is that mu squared is equal to 0. And going back to the first part of the title. So we want to understand if we can derive this from asymptotic safety. Now, there was a second motivation to actually introducing this framework. So if we talk about asymptotic safety, most of the computations are done in Euclidean signatures, because this is the simplest place. What we observe is that this is the tension, so our world is Lorentzian. So at the moment, there's a transition in the field that goes from Euclidean to Lorentzian signature computations, and introducing the ADM decomposition is one way to actually evoke this transition. So you can go to the ADM fields to get the right structure, and then you can do an analytic continuation of the lattice function. There are also alternative routes to address this transition. So this should be mentioned here as well. So one can compute spectral functions of metric fluctuations on a flat background. So this is what is followed by the Heidelberg group. Or the other alternative idea was to build on ideas from algebraic quantum field theory and merge them with the randomization group techniques here in this talk. So in principle, the last one would be an approach to work with the Lorentzian theory, which is essentially background independent. So all this is at the beginning. You see the works are quite recent, and I think in all directions there's much more to be explored. But for the purpose of this talk, I will follow the first part using ADM decompositions. Now, let's come to the interlude, the basics of asymptotic safety, because this is the quantum theory that I'm actually interested in when I do the computations for this talk. So I should stress that last year there was an extensive survey of the field. So that appeared in the handbook for quantum gravity. And all the contributions were organized by Roberto Percacci from CISA. And there were many people from the community that actually contributed and surveyed the status of the field in terms of various subfields. So there's a general introduction. There is a review about computations in flat space building on metric fluctuations. The status of adding matter has been reviewed, form factors, functional f of r approximations, down to phenomenological applications in cosmology and also in terms of applications of understanding black holes. Now, what is the basic idea? So if we talk about asymptotic safety, we are talking about an approach building on the ideas of the Wilsonian randomization group. Basically, what we want to do is we want to start from a quantum theory, then we want to organize the quantum fluctuations of this theory in high energy and low energy modes, and then we want to successively integrate out fluctuations shell by shell in a momentum space. So in principle, you could think about defining a theory at some intermediate scale lambda, and then you go down, integrate out your fluctuations until you have integrated out everything, and you understand, you arrive at the standard effective action of your theory. Now there's a question, how far up can you push the scale lambda where you set the initial conditions? And there will be some favorable conditions where you can actually remove this lambda. Now this is the basic idea. In order to realize this, we have to give a certain input. And in terms of gravity, this input will be the field content that we want to study. In our case, the space-time metric G or the ADM fields encoding the metric degrees of freedom, and we want to specify the symmetries. In the simplest case, this is diffeomorphism symmetry. If you talk about ADM fields, it might be foliation preserving diffeomorphisms as a subgroup. Now we want to build actions which are built from these fields and compatible with the symmetries. In the simplest case, such an action can be the Einstein-Hilbert action here, as serving as an example. Now, if we take all these actions and build them together, we obtain a linear space, so-called theory space. So by definition, this contains all actions that are compatible with my symmetries and can be built from the field content. Now, couplings in our theory, they essentially serve as coordinates on this space. Now, the theory space comes with a structure. This is the Wilsonian randomization group flow. Essentially, this describes how our couplings here change when we integrate out a quantum fluctuation. Typically, this is encoded in the beta functions of our theory. Now, this is the general setup. What is very important for us structurally are so-called randomization group fixed points. So this is, by definition, a point where all the beta functions vanish simultaneously. This is depicted here in the middle of this figure. So we have the fixed point here. And then we can look at the randomization group flow in the vicinity of this fixed point. Then we can distinguish two different classes of randomization group trajectories, the ones who track back into the fixed point at high energies, and ones that miss the fixed point if we go to high energies. By definition, we are only interested in the ones that end up at the fixed point at high energies. Now, what is the basic idea of asymptotic safety? The idea is that there is actually a fixed point for four-dimensional gravity, which can control the gravitational interactions at high energies. Now, what is the gain from having such a fixed point? And the gain is that it actually gives us predictive power. So let me spend two slides of explaining this point. So we have a randomization group fixed point. By definitions, the beta functions vanish at this fixed point. Now we can linearize the beta functions at this point that is written here. So the zeroth order term in this expansion vanishes due to the fixed point condition. So we get at the next order a differential equation which is linear. The coefficients here are the stability matrix, so the derivative of the beta functions evaluated at the fixed point. Now, the properties of the stability matrix actually encode the predictive power. How is this? So we can start from the linearized equation. We can construct the eigenvalues and the right eigenvectors of this equation. Conventionally, I want to trade the eigenvalues with stability coefficients. The difference here is a minus sign. And once I have this data, I can solve this linearized equation in terms of eigenvalues and the stability coefficients. Now, if I have a stability coefficients and where the real part, there should be a typo here. Is larger than zero, then the perturbation here vanishes automatically, and the CI here is a free parameter. Conversely, if this is smaller than zero, we are talking about a repulsive direction, and the condition that I'm hitting the fixed point as I send k to infinity says I must send the CI to zero. So in principle, having the fixed point approached at k goes to infinity gives a lot of conditions. So each repulsive direction gives me a condition and leaves only a few free parameters that describe my theorem. So for each coefficient theta, which is large with positive real part, I have one free parameter in my construction. Now, this is the high energy part of the theory. So we want to have a fixed point. We want to have a finite number of relevant parameters in order to have an infinite tower of predictions. But then on top of it, we want to have an effective action that is compatible with observations. So something that we can test in terms of general relativity and something that is compatible with the standard model of particle physics at energies that can be probed at collider experiments. Then I would say if we can meet this, we have a valid candidate for quantum gravity theory. On top of this, you could also place some structural demands. So does your quantum theory resolve space-time singularities? And does it correspond to a unitary theory in terms of propagation of your fields? So ideally, you would have all the four in this asymptotic safety package. Now, this is the summary of the structures that we are dealing with. Our arena is the theory space. The theory space comes with a Wilsonian randomization group flow. This is encoded in the beta functions. We are dealing with randomization group trajectories, which are the integral curves of these beta functions. And ideally, they interpolate between a fixed point at high energies and a standard effective action once we have integrated out all quantum fluctuations. Now, let me just pause. Are there any questions?
Yes, I have a question. What was the point A in the picture before?
The existence of a fixed point.
Ah, okay. That's just, there is a fixed point somewhere that I come from. Okay.
Yes. So Thanks. In principle, you have to check this by computations. It's not put in by hand. Either it exists or it doesn't exist.
Thank you.
Sorry, can I also ask a pretty basic question?
Sure.
In the usual sense in which RG is defined, we have a fixed background and then we do coarse graining.
Yes.
But here we're in the context of GR in which we don't have a fixed background. So how does RG happen?
Let me postpone this question. So this will be in the next block.
Okay.
Then practically, so we have all these abstract concepts now. How do we get them to work? So how do we get our beta functions that are essential for understanding the structure here on theory space? The idea that we used in this computation is the functional randomization group. So there are several incarnations. So Kelsen-Namanzig equation, De Wegener-Hauten, Polchinski, and in terms of practical computation, it's the latest kid on the block. So predominantly, people have used the Wetterich equation. So this is really a multi-purpose tool. So its application is not limited to gravity. So it can cover everything from scalar field theory up to condensed matter applications. And recently, there has been a long review describing all these applications in quite some detail. So if you're interested beyond the realm of gravity, you might have a look at this one. Now, the basic element on which the Wetterich equation builds is the so-called effective average action. So it contains the word average, effective action in the title. And you can think about it as a generalization of the standard effective action that you know from textbook quantum field theory. So in principle, the idea of this gamma K is that you have an explicit description of your quantum system, which includes all the quantum fluctuations at scales larger than K. Then there is this flow equation, which tells us how this object changes if we change our coarse-graining scale K. So in principle, it tells you when you integrate out fluctuations at scale K, how do the couplings of this object change? And this is given by this operator valued trace here on the right-hand side. So formally, this equation has the same information as a path integral formulation. Structurally, it's just better behaved. Also, you can analyze where the right-hand side has support. And most of the support comes from the region of fluctuations where the momentum is comparable to your coarse-graining scale. So in this sense, you really have the Wilsonian picture of integrating out quantum fluctuation shell by shell. The RK that appears here, this is a regulator function, and it has a dual purpose. So it regulates the theory both in the infrared and in the UV. So the factor in the numerator ensures that the trace is UV finite, while in the denominator, this RK essentially provides you a mass. And then the theory is also free of infrared divergence. Yes. It's also very flexible in terms of what you want to put in as a field content. So one, two, three scalar fields or gauge fields are easily added in this construction. Now there was the rightful question on how do you do coarse graining in a theory like GR, where the background or the metric is a dynamical object. And the answer to this question, so it's precisely here the complications. So how do you define a coarse-graining scale? And the basic idea that was developed is you use the background field method. So like in the beginning, you have a metric, you split it into a background and arbitrary fluctuations around the background. If you have this background, then you can use it to actually define your coarse-graining scale and also divide your fluctuations into high energy fluctuations or low energy fluctuations with respect to the scale. You can also do this geometrically, for example, by constructing the background Laplacian from this metric and then organizing fluctuations according to their spectrum with respect to this operator. In principle, there's also a long discussion about how to achieve background independence once you have added this additional structure. So in principle, the idea that goes around is that if you can quantize in all backgrounds simultaneously, then you will be able, then no background plays a distinguished role. And you might be able to actually get equations of motion that determine your background dynamically. So in this way, you essentially reconcile the use of the background field method with the structures that you know from general relativity. Now, if you adopt this, you can again derive the Wetterich equation for the effective average action. The only difference to the scalar example is that it involves more fields. So you have metric fluctuations, you have a fixed but arbitrary background metric, you have ghost degrees of freedom that comes from your gauge fixing procedure, So it's just the field content that is increased, but structurally, the equation retains its form. So the flow of the action itself knows about the propagator of the theory and the regulator. Now, what technically can probably not be done is solve this equation exactly. Formally, it's an exact equation, but in order to extract useful information from it, you need to use approximations. There's a whole zoo of things that you can do. Of course, you can resort to perturbation theory. So then you expand the right-hand side in a small coupling. And essentially what you then do is you can reproduce a loop expansion of your theory. At the non-perturbative level, this is probably not the strategy that you want to employ. So on top of perturbative expansions, you also have a set of non-perturbative approximations that you can employ to this equation. So in principle, these work with projecting the flow that is encoded here on a given subspace. Now the question is how to organize these subspaces. And in principle, there are three different expansion schemes that you can use. So you can order your expansion space by the number of derivatives that are contained in your actions. So then you work with a derivative expansion. Essentially, you are getting close to effective field theory. You can do something more refined. It's called a curvature expansion. Or you can expand this equation in powers of vertices or in powers of your fluctuation fields. So this is schematically how these expansions are done. You take your gamma, you expand it on your basis of action functionals. The expansion coefficients are your coupling constants U here, and you limit the number of action functionals to a finite and typically small number. Then you substitute into the Wetterich equation, you compare left-hand side and right-hand side, and you would be able to read off the beta functions as coefficients in this expansion. Now, structurally, this projection can, on the left-hand side, can be at zeroth order of the fluctuation field. That is typically referred to as a background computation. Or it can involve a projection on higher order correlation functions of the fluctuation field. So in principle, you can take derivatives of the Wetterich equation with respect to the fluctuations and then get information about the scale dependence of the coupling constants that appear here. Now it might be useful to have an example on how such an expansion could be organized. Here, I'm taking the simplest case, a scalar field theory. Then typically what you would include on the right-hand side is first the kinetic term, the corresponding coupling. Associated with this will be the wave function randomization of your field. You can define the interaction monomial, which is quadratic in the field. Then the coupling would be the mass of the field. You could go to interactions, adding a phi to the four interaction, and then this would be the lambda coupling describing a phi to the four self interaction. So this gives probably a feeling what can appear here on the right hand side in terms of a scalar field theory. Now, in terms of gravity, you can build a similar expansion. So, in principle, you can use scalar curvature invariance in order to build up your basis OI. In the simplest case for the Einstein-Hilbert action, this will involve essentially the volume operator and the operator containing the Ricci scalar. But you see, allowing for more and more derivatives, the number of curvature scalars that you can construct actually proliferates quite quickly. Now, having this expansion, what you can do is you can introduce certain, you can combine these towers of derivatives into functions of the Laplacian. In this way, you go from a derivative expansion in terms of a curvature expansion. So in principle, you organize your expansion in terms of the power of curvature tensors that are used here. And then you have condensed essentially an infinite tower of these interaction terms in terms of one potentially scale-dependent function. The third part, expansion in fluctuation fields. So we exploit that gamma depends on the fluctuations, and then we can expand in the powers of this fluctuation field H. And at some point, we limit ourselves to a certain power. So this can also be used to include derivatives or the momentum of our fields here. So the vertices that appear here can, in principle, be momentum dependent. Now, given this set of approximations, a fair question is, what should I use? If you are interested in only qualitative results, like the existence of fixed points, probably the simplest approximations will give you this information already. So for example, the fixed point that we need in terms of gravity is already visible if we only have two basis elements, like the Einstein-Hilbert, as in the form of the Einstein-Hilbert action. Now, if you want to have information about critical exponents or the free parameters of your theory, then the tool of choice is a derivative expansion. So in principle, from all the studies that have been done so far, taking the number of derivatives as an order parameter gives you a good estimate whether a certain operator is RG relevant or irrelevant. Now, there are also structural questions where a derivative expansion is not tool of choice. So if you want to answer questions about the degrees of freedom that are present in the theory, then you have to track back the momentum dependence of your couplings. So in principle, then you have to move from a derivative expansion to a curvature expansion in order to track this information. Now, this is a word of warning. What about the physics? Where should we get this from? And in principle, the answer, or my answer to this question, is the following. So if we want to study physical effects, then this should always be based on gamma, defined as the limit of our effective average action where all quantum fluctuations have been integrated out. So in principle, the idea behind this is, if we have a standard field, quantum field theory, then in order to describe physics, all quantum fluctuations should be accounted for. This has a few conceptual consequences. So if we talk about couplings that flow with the coarse-graining scale K, this flow is probably not observable. Then you can ask, okay, how do we see the energy dependence of coupling constants that appear in, for example, particle physics? And the answer is, these are encoded in the form factors that appear in gamma. So essentially, a momentum dependent of the coupling is encoded in functions of this form. That entails that Newton's coupling should be constant, no energy dependence, and also the cosmological constant should have no energy dependence, simply because I cannot associate momentum-dependent form factors with these two couplings. And if you adopt this viewpoint, this also resolves the puzzle that was placed by Donoghue a few years ago about trying to reconcile gravity-mediated scattering processes with the idea that they should be described by a K dependence, which is identified with the energy dependence. So simply this process doesn't work because the Newton's coupling only exhibits a K dependence in terms of one function, while you see that in terms of form factors, you have two independent form factors that enter into the scattering processes, and then just having the running of G with respect to K is not sufficient to completely couple this. Now, applications. So we want to apply this machinery to the graviton two-point functions. So we want to use Wettrich's equation. We write it for the ADM variables introduced in the beginning. And we have two interesting limits that we are interested in. So K goes to infinity, the Bayer theory, and this is the limit where we obtain our predictive power. And then the limit K goes to zero. So here all quantum fluctuations are integrated out, and here we should get our physics. So we want to take this equation and we want to solve it to obtain a complete RG trajectory interpolating between the two. Now, what is the object of interest that we want to compute? Essentially, we borrow intuition from the introduction and we want to have the two-point functions of our transverse traceless field HIJ. What we do, we promote the wave function randomization and the mass that appears here in this expression to be scale dependent. Then we want to use this correlation functions on the left-hand side of our flow equation. So essentially this defines the operator on which we want to project our flow. Now, how does this look structurally? So we start from the Wettrich equation. We take two derivatives with the field that we are interested in. On the left-hand side, this gives us the scale dependence of the two-point function. And on the right-hand side, these derivatives generate a bubble diagram involving two three-point vertices and a bubble diagram built on the four-point vertex. So you can translate diagrams to the expression that sit here. The DTRK is this cross here. The Gs are the regularized propagators. These are sitting here, here, and here. And then here with the external line, I have the three-point interactions gamma three. And here, this point where four lines meet, this is the four-point vertex. Now we see if we want to have a flow of a two-point functions, we need the three and the four-point vertex. Now, how do we generate this? So we take an ansatz for our effective average action, which involves gravity, scalar matter, and U1 gauge fields. The gravitational part is taken at the Einstein-Hilbert action, suitable gauge fixed. So if we expand this in the fluctuation fields and take the two-point function in HIJ on a flat background, this precisely gives us the correlation function that we are interested in. And then all the other fields that appear in this decomposition will appear on the right-hand side of the equation. So essentially, these are the fields that can propagate here in the loop and drive the flow of the two-point function. So the blue part generates the correlation function that we are interested in. And taken all together, this ansatz also generates the 3 and 4 point vertices that we need to actually close our randomization group equation. So in principle, it's the exercise of extracting the Feynman rules for our fields from this ansatz. Then we can do the computation. And as a result, we get beta functions for our dimensionless couplings G and lambda. Keep in mind that the lambda that appears here in this expansion is also related to the mass of the graviton. So this is the relation here. The result is complicated, so let's not put it on slides. Let's leave it in Mathematica. But structurally, it depends on the number of the meta fields that we have put in. So essentially, the scalars and the vectors can also propagate in the loops and give contributions to the flow of these couplings at the two-point level. Now, naturally, the special interests are in the zeros of these beta functions because these are the fixed points that we are interested in. Now, what did we learn from this computation? In the first step, we surveyed the number of fixed points that these beta functions have as a number of our fields. And you see that there is a regime in field space where there are 3 fixed points. There's a regime where there's 1 fixed point. And here, there's a separation line where something happens. Now, the something, what happens, can be depicted here on the right-hand side. So what we did is we fixed the number of scalar fields to be 4 to move on this horizontal line. If you have 0 vector fields, then there are 3 fixed points. This is the green line, there's blue line, and the orange line. And as we go to the right, there's a number of vector fields where 2 of these fixed points collide and essentially vanish into the complex plane. Now there's also the question, which is the one that is interesting for asymptotic safety? This is the blue line that is sitting here. So this fixed point only exists for a low number of meta fields before it actually vanishes in the complex plane. Now for gravity, we have this set of 3 fixed points. So we can ask question, which one is relevant? And for that, we actually plotted the flow diagram. So the arrows here is the vector field generated by our beta functions. All the arrows point from high energy to low energy. So follow the flow to go to k equals to 0. Then you see that there are some singular lines where our beta functions are ill-defined. This is the red line here, and this boundary line sitting here. And the interesting region is the interior of the phase space. So there we see there are 3 special points. And the interplay of these 3 points actually govern how the flow diagram looks like. So there is a fixed point at the origin. So this is the free field theory. There's a fixed point here. This is the non-Gaussian fixed point in blue. And then there's an infrared fixed point sitting here. Asymptotic safety is associated with this fixed point. So it controls all the RG trajectory in the vicinity as we send k to infinity. Now, if we emanate from this fixed point, the interesting phase is the one that is bounded here by this black diagram. So here, all the RG trajectories essentially exhibit a universal behavior. They emanate from this fixed point in UV. This is the plateau here. They cross over, and then they develop a distinct scaling behavior as we send k to 0. So essentially, the coupling, the dimensionless coupling lambda approaches 0.5 in a very well-defined way. So besides a UV fixed point, we also have an infrared fixed point, which attracts our RG trajectories in this corner for k goes to 0. Now, what does this mean? If lambda approaches a constant value as you send k to 0, that means that the dimensionful mass of the graviton is dynamically driven to 0 at this point. So this happens for all the trajectories that actually sit in this triangle. Now, we can move along and start checking what happens with this infrared effect when we go and add meta fields. And then we again move along the horizontal line. So we study this particular case of four scalars and one vector. And one sees that dynamically, really nothing has changed in your phase diagram. So again, we have the interplay of these three fixed points and an infrared fixed point driving the dimensionful graviton mass to 0. So qualitatively, this case is quite similar to the one that we discussed for pure gravity. Now we can cross the transition line and go to the phase where our high energy completion is absent. So there you see the phase diagram changed tremendously. The non-Gaussian fixed point that was used to be here is gone. However, the other two that appear in the infrared are still there. In particular, the infrared fixed point still persists and it's able to drive the graviton mass to 0, is irrespective if your RG trajectory has a higher energy completion or not. So this is really a feature that appears in the low energy part of your flow. And you see here, the trajectories just terminate at the finite value of k. You cannot reach k goes to infinity. So this is the endpoints that we have here, but the infrared mechanism associated with this point is still there. Now, I want to add one brief statement about transiting to Lorentzian signature. That was the second motivation that we had for this framework. And also there are some preliminary insights that we got. So if we have the ADM decomposition, then we can compose any momentum into a time part and a spatial part. Then we can construct a specific type of regulator, which only depends on the spatial momenta. The advantage is if you use this regularization procedure, then you don't modify the analytic structure of your propagators. You don't get any additional poles in the complex momentum plane. Drawback, clearly this regulator is not Lorentz covariant because it only depends on the spatial momenta. So nothing comes for free. However, then you can analytically continue Lorentz function from n to in. And then you observe that essentially the beta functions that you have of this after this analytic continuation stay exactly the same. So for both signatures, you get the same flow equation. In particular, any non-Gaussian fixed point that you find on the Euclidean side will carry over to the Lorentzian side as well. Now, this brings me to the summary. So what we did is we started to look into the RG flow of the graviton two-point function. So this was the correlation function. We found that there is a non-Gaussian fixed point that controls the high energy completion. And we also found that there is an IR fixed point which drives the mass that are sitting here to 0 dynamically. We also found that the last property is independent of whether we have this UV completion or not. So probably this is something that can be seen in an effective field theory approach as well. Now, if we have an outlook, so clearly starting with this two-point function could be the first step towards looking at cosmological observables. So in principle, you can generalize from a flat background to a cosmological background, and you can generalize the momentum dependence of your two-point function. So we had only a p squared term. In principle, there can be more. Also, the transition from two-point correlations to three-point correlations might give interesting insights about non-Gaussianities within the theory. We can also use it to transition from Lorentzian, from Euclidean to Lorentzian signature by an analytic continuation of the lapse function. So in this way, we could get some more insights about the relations between Euclidean and Lorentzian settings. So, and given that I was asked to stay within the 50 minutes marks, this leaves still room for questions. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
So maybe
from the room, yeah, there's a question in the room. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I have maybe two questions. So I'm still wondering about like the coarse graining that you're doing in the RGU flow.
Mm-hmm.
So if I understand correctly, you're doing background, you fix a background and you expand perturbatively around that. Right? And then
yes.
So like the confusion I have is like what in this context, right? Physically, what does it mean to have a fixed point? Like what is the fixed point telling us about the physics? So let me make, yeah, sorry, just in, for example, in condensed matter, the why we're doing coarse grading and then we're doing RG flow is because we want to probe like critical phenomena.
So, yes, but the fixed points that you have in condensed matter are typically fixed points in the infrared. So they appear in the limit where we have k goes to zero. And in principle, so you can be minimalistic in terms of the setting, saying that you only want to have physics in the regime where all quantum fluctuations are accounted for. And then the role of your fixed point will only be the role of having predictive power.
Right.
That would be minimalistic. Then you can also say, okay, could I meaningfully give an interpretation of your fixed point in terms of geometry or whatever? And this is much harder.
So that's my question.
So at the moment, I have no good interpretation of this fixed point in terms of geometric quantities.
Okay.
But my intuition is that at this point, having a fixed background might not be a good thing in order to describe physics. Just a classical manifold might fail in terms of structures.
Okay.
So Brownian spheres or something might be more suitable to give a geometric description to this point.
Okay, all right. So there was a question online by Laurent, I think. And there's also raised then. So
It was just maybe if you could go back a little bit more to the details of the RG flow with ADM variable.
I didn't give too much details on this.
That, and usually when you have this split of space and time and you do the RG,
yes,
it's not completely clear you preserve the Lorentz invariants, or do you do, I mean, you went, it looks like what you're doing is the same for ADM and the covariant, but can you comment on these issues that?
Yes.
So, you know, I don't, I where is the, I mean, maybe you skipped over the technical detail of how you do the RG in.
Yes, in but ADM, the brief answer is in the setup. So I should go, yes, to the point symmetries here. And if you have covariant formalism, then you can preserve background diffeomorphisms. If you have the ADM decomposition, you only preserve a subgroup. So you have only foliation preserving diffeomorphisms, and presently, the formulation that we have actually breaks Lorentz symmetry explicitly. So this is really a drawback of the construction where we are thinking about how to fix this. And one particular idea in this direction was developed by Benjamin Knorr. So he used the covariant formulation and added the vector n that I had in the beginning geometrically as an additional datum. And in this way, he was able to get RG flows that are manifestly Lorentz covariant. But with the ADM fields directly, this is difficult.
Okay. Because so you're saying you're breaking it. Yeah, because so eventually it means that maybe the RG flow explores more the parameter of Ojava gravity, right?
Yes, this is true. And so the natural setting is Ojava.
Okay, but then when you analyze the phase space diagram, are you in that Ojava context or in the covariant context?
The projection is essentially onto the covariant subspace.
Mm-hmm. But can you check in your numerics that somehow you are not deviating away from the covariant or? But that the
yes, I can check this, but the answer is I'm deviating. Okay.
It's a relevant direction.
Yes. So if I use flows in the ADM formalism, I get a component which is orthogonal to the covariant subspace.
Okay.
So this is the state of the art that we have at the moment with these flow equations.
So it would flow out.
It flow out. So if you allow it, if you allow a direction that is not Lorentz covariant, it would flow out. Mm-hmm. You would generate a flow in this direction.
Is there a way to think about the Hamiltonian constraints and kind of repairing this issue?
Yes. Or precisely as we had at the beginning. So I think the best way to fix this is essentially having higher order fluctuation fields in this decomposition.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not there yet.
Yeah, so there's a question in the room, Mark.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for the nice talk. I have a question about the vanishing of a non-Gaussian fixed point when you increase the number of vector fields. You mentioned it was an annihilation. Is it really an annihilation in the sense of two fixed points colliding and vanishing into a complex plane, or is it more like a divergence and it reappears at negative new
fixed point collision.
Then I'm confused because in this phase diagram later you showed at nv equals 10, you still showed that there's two fixed points remaining, the Gaussian one and the infrared fixed point. So which fixed point does the non-Gaussian fixed point one collide with?
Here I only depicted three non-Gaussian fixed points. So the Gaussian fixed point and the infrared fixed point is not part of the diagram.
I see. Okay.
So it's three non-Gaussian ones, and in these plots, these other ones sit outside of this boundary. So they are above here and way above here. And you see that in this plot, some fixed point is moving to infinity and comes back before annihilating.
All right, I see. Thanks. And the second question would be, so you include scalars and vectors, and I guess an obvious question would be fermions, and is there a conceptual issue with adding fermions in that setup? So is there a question about like the spin connection unfoliated spaces, or is this the obvious next step?
It could be a next step to include.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
Okay, so I think we can thank Frank again.
Bye-bye.